Hello and welcome to the Drum History Podcast. I'm your host, Bart Vanderzee, and today I'm joined by Mr. Richard King to talk about drum collecting and drum shows. Richard, welcome to the podcast.
Howdy.
Yeah, so this is going to be cool. I love doing these episodes about collecting and collectors and drum shows and all that cool stuff and how they all work together. You have an interesting kind of role in this world where you're kind of a high-end dealer to a lot of different people and do all kinds of things. But before we get into talking about drum collecting and some of the history of it, going back into the 80s and drum shows and all that stuff, why don't you tell us about yourself a little bit?
Well, I live in Maryland now, but I grew up in the New Jersey area. Started out in Edison and then lived in Irvington and then East Brunswick. And that was the era of all these great music stores that were privately owned. This is pre big box stores. And we had Mascaro's Music in Union, New Jersey, and we had Lou Rose Music in Edison, New Jersey, and we had Highway Music in East Brunswick. And these were all really great music stores that had brand new Slinglin, Gretsch, Rogers, and whatever. I used to pedal my little bicycle to these stores because I didn't have a driver's license then. And I used to steal the little drum catalogs wherever they had them lying around.
Yeah.
And they would chase me out of there. But the drums, they weren't vintage then. They were still being actively built, you know, and you'd see these amazing brand new Ludwig, you know, and Rogers and Zickos and Fives, all these great companies, you know.
Yeah.
And I bought my very first drum set. I saved up my paper route money and bought for $100 a used Zimgar drum set.
Wow.
This is a lot of money back then, you know.
Yeah, really.
Uh-huh. And it was a cool kit because it was in black diamond pearl and had the little round badges, just like on a Brooklyn Gretsch kit, you know?
Yeah.
And right away, I was taking it apart, putting new heads on it. And then I put a Roger Swivomatic Tom holder on there because the old rail concert was just flopping over. And I just loved working on drums. And I've always been an active drummer, still am. And I always worked on drums on the side for fun, as a passion, you know?
Yeah.
And I still do that today.
Yeah. Those Japanese kits, it's so interesting how I think they're great because, I mean, you could buy one as a kid. You could save up your money and buy one. And it really, I mean, by design, it looks like the drums that you can't afford as a kid. It gives you that taste of you know, and they really, they sound, minus, you know, maybe the rails and stuff, like the hardware could be a little better, but they're really nice drums. I always have a special place in my heart for those.
Me too.
But you have since then graduated from the Japanese stencil kits and have really dealt with some of the finest drums in the world and hardware and memorabilia and all that good stuff. So let's just kind of hear about your background, but also really the history of drum collecting and drum shows as we go. So where does it all start?
Okay. Well, by 1984, there was starting to be a little bit of a buzz, a little bit of chatter around the country about old drums. They didn't call them vintage then. And there was a small article in Modern Drummer on vintage drums and collecting them. It was written by Rick Van Horn. And he talked briefly about Radio Kings and Gretsches. And that was one of the first mentions of collecting vintage drums, and he had pictures of old Ludwig and Ludwig bass drums with the scenery on them and stuff. Mm-hmm. And it was very interesting to see that. But I already had the bug at that time, and I started to work for a local music store here in Annapolis, Maryland, called Master Musicians. And at that time, they were just a kind of a regular, you know, guitar and amplifiers and PA drum music store, you know. And one day, somebody showed up with a 1950s Slinglin Green Sparkle drum set, three piece. And I was like, oh, wow, look at that, vintage drums, you know, and I just had that article still in my head from Modern Drummer. And the owner of the store was a gentleman by the name of Jonas Aronson. And we started talking about vintage drums and how cool they were. And next thing you know, Jonas decided to start putting a little advertisement in the back of the Modern Drummer magazine, mm-hmm. just saying, you know, if you're interested in vintage drums, it was a little tiny little article, or not even article, but a little advertisement in the very back pages. You had to pay like $100 for that back then.
Yeah.
And people would start to call into the music store, say, hey, I'm kind of interested in looking at some drums. And within like, I would say within like in 2 or 3 years, it went from zero to like 100. because people saw that little ad and started calling up saying, hey, I got an old drum set I want to sell, or
wow,
or we got something, we're looking for a Radio King or a Black Beauty, you know. And and that's when we started hearing about all these things, because I was very, very uneducated as far as the 1920s and 30s and 40s go. I was very well appraised with 60s and 70s stuff.
Yeah.
And so Master Musicians started doing a newsletter. We used to send a newsletter out all over the country, and that it got bigger incrementally over the years and months that we did that. And at that time, there was another drum company called Vintage Drum Center with Ned Ingerman, and he started getting into the vintage drum business as well. And he started putting out a newsletter. But at that time, he was based in New York, and then he made the move over to Iowa, to Libertyville, Iowa. He started his drum letter. And then several other people popped up. Bobby Chison with Jollity Drum Farm. And then there was Leon Wall, and a great guy, started a company called Drummer's Tradition in San Francisco. And then you have people just popping up all over the place, little by little. And by 1989 or 1990, there was quite a bit of interest. And that was when I started to hear from Rob Cook as well. I used to see, he used to call us, and we used to do some horse trading back and forth. And right around 1990, a local gentleman by the name of Mike Cairo here in Bethesda, Maryland, had the very first, I would say, official drum show in 1990, I believe it was. It might have been 89, but I'm pretty sure it was 1990, over in Bethesda, Maryland. And he had a little drum shop called the Drum Cellar. And he was the one that put the very first vintage drum show. And all the players were there at that show. You know, Rob Cook was there, Jack Lawton. Master Musicians, of course, we were there. And a lot of the guys that you see nowadays at drum shows were there all those years ago, 30 plus years ago.
Man.
Really exciting.
It is exciting. I mean, there's so much there, too, which I have a bunch of questions. But the first one, though, is going on that drum show. I mean, I think everyone who goes to a drum show has kind of a different reason for going. So personally, when I go to one, it's usually to make for networking for the podcast. It's to find guests. That's my reason. And then also I like to look at the drums. But people go to acquire drums for their stores to stock them. People go for the love of just meeting and networking without having a podcast or a reason to do it. But also there's just these people who collect, who drums come in. And they don't really go out. Early on in that first drum show in 90 or 89, what would you say was the main, you know, was it really, let's just see how this is going for a lot of people? Or what was the main reason people wanted to go at that point?
Oh, people came there to buy. A lot of collectors came there to buy and see and look around.
Yeah.
It was kind of a first attempt by a lot of people on expanding their collections.
Yeah. Now, prices, because you hear people like Terry Keating, like Bonzolium and stuff. A lot of people will talk about, you know, you would get a Ludwig kit for like $150. I mean, things were so cheap because the market hadn't totally blown up and inflated. How did you see things with prices from that original, let's say, 84-ish, 85 to 90? Had things been steadily rising when you finally got to that first drum show?
Just a little bit. They really hadn't changed a whole lot at that point.
Okay. Yeah. Do you remember yourself? Did you acquire anything cool back then? Or what was your collection like in those days, which I'm sure it's changed a lot and your business has grown, but what was your experience like there?
My initial foray into vintage drums was all about Trixon drums.
Oh.
And my handle used to be King Trixon because I had over 100 Trixon drums in my collection.
Wow.
And because I wanted to find something that was really hard to find, that was difficult. You know, because Ludwigs and Gretsches, there's a lot of that stuff. I mean, there's some rare Gretsches and rare Ludwigs, but Trixons in this country are extremely rare. And that even then until now, even they're still very rare.
Yeah.
Know, very hard to find.
I have wanted and been trying to do, it's not like I work on it every single day, but to do a Trixon episode, but everyone usually refers me to, I believe his name is Ingo.
Yeah, Ingo. He's the master.
And he has said, this was, I probably haven't talked to him in about 2 years, but he said, I don't know. He basically said, I don't know if my English is good enough. And I'm like, you know, thinking, let's try. Like, because everyone else is kind of like, he's got to do it. Like, he's the man to do it. yeah. And they don't want to do it. So it's even the episode about Trixon is elusive and hard. Maybe you're the guy for it. If you're King Trixon, you know,
I'm retired from the King Trixon business.
Did you find Trixons there?
Oh yeah. 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 As soon as I put the word out that I want a Trixon, people started writing in saying, "Hey, I got this Trixon bongos." And I was always looking for parts because the big problem with Trixons is you get them missing parts or missing hoops or whatever. So I was always putting out feelers there for old music stores that were Trixon dealers. I said, "Hey, you got any little Trixon screws or brackets in the back or drum heads?" And they're like, "Yeah, we got one or two, you know?"
Yeah.
So I was very fortunate because there was still in 1990, a few music stores that were still, were originally Trixon dealers back in the 60s that were still in business. So I was able to get a lot of parts from those guys.
Interesting.
I amassed a large Trixon collection of parts, stands, rims, drum heads, you name it.
Yeah, because the drum heads are not for the particular, is it the speed? It's the Speedfire kit, right? That has the
Speedfire.
Yeah, that's, you know, you don't go to Guitar Center and buy one of those bass drums. Mm-hmm. All right, so let's move forward here with drum collecting, because things really blew up, and nowadays stuff is astronomically expensive for some drum sets. So where did it go from there?
Well, to be perfectly honest with you, the drum collecting business has never been hugely popular or profitable as the guitar collecting business. Hmm. You know, the guitar collecting business started back in the 70s and 80s, roughly on the same level as drums. But then sometime in the 80s, it just went to stratospheric levels. The prices went up and they've never come down. Now, it's very different for drums. Our drums have incrementally gone up in value, but you can still buy like a good, nice vintage kit for about $1,500. You know what I mean? You can't do that with a guitar, you know, like a Strat.
Yeah. Why is that? I mean, if you had to guess, why is it? Because when I worked at Guitar Center, even I remember that, like, you know, the guys in, you know, I worked there for a summer, but like the guys in the guitar department were selling five guitars a day. I worked there for 4 or 5 or 6 months and I didn't sell a single drum set. I would say it's space. They're big. They're, you know, there's not as, maybe everyone besides, you know, ultra collectors, they don't have a lot of space. I mean, what do you think?
Yeah. Well, first of all, there's a lot less drummers than there are guitar players. The guitar players outnumber us like 100 or 1,000 to 1, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And you're right. The drums take up a lot more space. They're noisier. And so a lot of mom and pops, they don't want their kids playing drums. They're like, "Why don't you play flute, you know, or acoustic guitar?" Yeah. Don't play the drums.
Yeah, no drums.
I was very fortunate because my mother was very supportive of my drum playing, and she wanted me to play at home as much as possible. So I got to practice every day in my basement.
Yeah.
Well, the flip side of that is that if you have a drummer or a guitar player that really wants to play, they're going to play no matter what.
Yeah.
That's the way I was. I was going to play no matter what, you know.
Yeah, yeah. All right, so prices are, you know, like you said, they're maintaining. We hadn't really got to that boom. So after the drum show in 90, the first one in Maryland, right?
Yes.
What happened after that?
Well, they only had two shows in Bethesda, the 90 and the 91, and that was it. And Mike was done. And then Rob Cook grabbed the football and ran with it, and he started his first drum show. At I think they had their first drum show at Cook's Music, which is in Alma, Michigan, and then they moved it over to where the famous music store that was in Chicago. What was that called? Maury Lishon's shop, but they moved it to that location. I think it was called Frank's Drum Shop. Maybe I lose track. They Rob Cook ran with that, and then also right around the same time that Rob Cook ran with the drum show idea, my good friend Jack Lawton over here in Pennsylvania started his first show in Sellens Grove, Pennsylvania, and started a Pennsylvania Vintage Drum Show. So those guys were kind of neck and neck starting around the same time, you know, and those grew very quickly. The Rob Cook drum show was very, very small, one room, and it blew up, and so did Jack's drum show.
Yeah. Rob's been on the show, I think, more than anyone else, over 150 episodes. He's been on about 5 times, and he's talked a lot about the Chicago show. But, I mean, you're not doing these drum shows to, like, be stuffing cash in your pockets. I mean, it's really a labor of love, and I think it's awesome they do it. And for people, every time we talk about shows, I always say, it's just like, you gotta go. You got to experience it at least once, because it's so, and you got to put yourself out there. And I've learned too, that it's very much like each year you get more and more friendly with people and you recognize people. And I know a lot of guys of your generation are, I mean, everyone, it all seems like they're friends and they're connected and they've grown and they've experienced this stuff together and they've bought and sold and traded. So it's really cool. It's such a cool experience.
To expand on that, when I first started going to the Chicago show in the 90s, I only went there to socialize, basically. I would fly out there, rent a car, and I would hang around for the weekend and just watch everybody and talk to people. And it was a great opportunity to meet with people that I'd talked with on the telephone for years and years at Master Musicians before there was the internet, you know.
Yeah.
And it was a great opportunity to get together and meet with people and hang out. And then after a couple of years, I was like, wow, you know, there's some really good prices here. I might have to start buying. So then I started driving out there. Now I drive out there.
Yeah. I mean, that's it's funny to see people's cars when they're either when they're leaving with just absolutely stuffed with drums. And that's an interesting thing, too, is you get the deals in the part. There's deals in the parking lot. There's like meeting with people, you know, on the side. There's the Sunday at 5:00. Like, I don't want to take this home kind of deals that you get, right. Which is interesting. There's a lot of tactics. But you have, as I referred in the Lewis Bernstein episode, which, you know, people can go check out. Lewis basically downsized his collection and you helped with that. You made this into a business. So as we're talking about this, when did that come into play with you realizing that, like you said, hey, there's some good deals here, but mm-hmm. you help other people facilitate these deals. When did that start to happen?
Well, what happened is while I was working at Master Musicians, we did everything through the store. We did consignments, we did purchases, and all that stuff was handled through the store. Master Musicians went out of business in 2002 because we had three Mars guitar centers there, and the guitar center itself moved into the area. So that kind of forced that business to go out of control. So we could no longer maintain that. So what happened is, at 2002, I had a dilemma because I didn't really know what I was going to do. I was still working full time in the band and working at the music store. So when the music store closed up, I was like, I don't know what the heck I'm going to do. But the one thing that was really cool was back in about 1998, we started doing eBay at Master Musicians, and I learned how to work. And it basically made all my mistakes on eBay at the store. So in 2002, I started my own business on eBay called King's Music. And I went around and I started to do everything I was doing at the store, only privately. But it was really hard because I had a very limited budget. I didn't have a ton of money, you know?
Yeah.
And so I started kind of splitting my part of it being purchasing, and part of my business was selling stuff on consignment. I would sell all kinds of drums for other collectors that were thinning out their collections. And I've done that a number of times, you know, so that kind of worked out in my favor. But what happened also on eBay is that I made good money with the drums, and I turned over a lot of stuff. But more and more, I found that the hardware, the stands, the lugs, the bits, was way more profitable because you could buy that at a much lower price, and I was able to turn that over. And I kept looking back at the numbers. I'd look at the drums and I was like, we made this money on the drums. I'd look at all the money we made on the hardware. Holy crap. And so my specialty became hardware. And that's when I really started focusing on buying hardware. So a lot of guys would see me at the drum show and my car would just be packed full of hardware. Like you said, driving back down I-90 back to Maryland, and my Honda Pilot would just be loaded down in the back, you know, to the roof with hardware, you know?
An extra 1,000 pounds of hardware.
That poor car.
Someone's got to do it. You know what I mean? Like, I like how there's these specialized, you sound like, I mean, going from Trixon to hardware, you realize that it is a business and that you need to kind of pick your, I'm sure you'd still buy a good deal, you know, drum set and sell it or whatever, but it's just like hardware is small. It's lower. So you can sell a lot more of it. You can sell a lot more lugs than you can $1,500 vintage drum sets or something like that.
Yeah.
Now you don't have to give away your secrets or anything, but where would you be in those days? And whenever now, where do you acquire this stuff? Are you hunting for it a lot, or do people bring it to you a lot?
I don't really have to hunt it a whole lot because a lot of people know me for this. Mm-hmm. So I get a lot of calls from collectors and dealers who are not necessarily liquidating their collection of drums, but in buying all these drums, they ended up with boxes and boxes of hardware. And they'll say, Rich, you got to come here and clean me out. I got way too much hardware. And so I would drive to Michigan or Pennsylvania or Maine or whatever and load my car up with a ton of hardware. And a lot of it just came by referral, by word of mouth. I didn't really have to go looking.
Yeah. And I really like how you said, too, that you learned, you know, when you were at Master Musicians, right? That's the name.
Yeah.
The process of eBay and all this stuff, because it's not easy to do this. It's not, this stuff takes time. And I've recently been, I always have non-drum related, like reference, like parallel things that happen, but I've been doing Facebook advertising and Google ads for a guy I shoot video for psychology seminars. Man, I mean, these Facebook ads and Google ads, it's kind of complicated and you really have to learn it. But when someone else is paying for it and you're on the clock with them, it really takes a load off. And it's kind of like, all right, I'm working right now, but I'm learning keywords and things. So it's eBay and all this stuff. It's not just snap a picture, put it up. You need a nice, clean description. You need photos. I mean, all this stuff. So the fact that you could learn and make that work, I think was very advantageous of you to use that time to make a business out of it for yourself.
I was very fortunate because I was able to look over the shoulder of the webmaster at the store as he did the eBay, and I would watch what he did and emulated it and learn how to do it on my own, you know, because if somebody just said, you know, hey, go and do eBay and figure it out on my own, I would have been years trying to figure that out. But by being able to watch the other guy and saw how he did it, it really helped speed things up.
Yeah. I mean, because what you see when you go to someone's page, there's a lot on the back end. I've learned too, there's like the whole storefront. I mean, if you're treating it like a business, you really need, I mean, your reviews matter. And then you've got it. You're like a shipping and handling department as well. I mean, you're all this stuff, which we'll talk about that. But do you think eBay is now as prominent as it was then? Because there's now Craigslist and Facebook and all these things. Do people use eBay just as much?
Well, eBay, the one thing that's eBay that has that is unique is their auctions, 7-day live auctions. And I still use those from time to time. That's basically where I'll start something at 99 cents with no reserve and just let it roll. You don't really have that with Marketplace or with Reverb or Craigslist for that matter. You buy whatever the price is or you negotiate it, but there's no bidding, you know, and that's, people still like to bid. It's still a horse race, you know, it's still like kind of like gambling with dice.
Yeah.
And that's why when I put it up, I started at 99 cents and just, you know, roll the dice and let it go, you know?
Yeah.
Sometimes it pays and sometimes it doesn't.
I was going to say, you have to have been, I don't want to say burned, but sometimes if stuff doesn't go, I'm sure you have that feeling of like, you know, I wish I could undo that.
Yeah. Well, you know what you got into something, you know what you paid for, and then you end up selling it for like a lot less than what you paid for, you know, but I always keep reminding myself it's a game of numbers. At the end of the year, if you look at what you bought versus what you made, it always works out up in the plus category. So you can't look at the individual auction, go, oh, and kill yourself. Oh, yeah. That, you know?
Yeah. Are you a numbers guy? Like, are you good with like, I don't want to say good with finances, because that's sort of different of like, oh, I'm, you know, I'm good at budgeting, but are you good at like bookkeeping for your own business and stuff? Was that always something you were good at, or did you have to teach yourself that?
I had a lot of help from an accountant. Okay. I take all my taxes and all my Schedule C, deductions to an accountant, and she helps me and she guides me on what I can do and what I can't do illegally. But I've always used their help because on my own I'd be screwed.
Oh yeah. As you go though, are you keeping track of like in an Excel spreadsheet or something? Like, all right, this sold for $20. Are you keeping track of everything, or does eBay have a nice like back end that?
I don't write that. I keep a printout of every auction. I can go back and review, but I basically keep a running number in the back of my head on what sells, what doesn't sell, how much this sells against that.
Got it.
When I go into a music store or I go to look at a collection of hardware, I look at everything as a dollar amount. You know, how much was this one screw? How much can I get for it? Because a lot of times the hardware that you buy, that I buy, doesn't have a name on it. It's just a piece of hardware.
Yeah.
You got to know what you're looking at.
Yeah.
And you're looking at a box with 1,000 bits and pieces in it. You got to be able to pick out what's going to make you money. And that's something that I've gotten pretty good at because I've had so much practice. I've been doing it for so long now. And I have all the catalogs and the parts lists and the parts indexes and stuff like that that have really been helpful Because there's sometimes where I'll find something and I'll be like, what the heck is this? And I'll be able to go back in like some old 1920s Leedy catalog. And it's like, oh, it's that flippant of a thing, you know?
Wow. So yeah. Interesting. So if people listening are looking for a 1920s flibbity bib, what, I mean, would they come to you? And was that a good route for people to say, hey, I need this?
Yeah, that's worked out real well, because over the years I've had some people that were looking for very specific things, you know, for restorations, where they were trying to restore a vaudeville drum set. Or I actually did some work for the movies where they wanted specific drums for a specific time era. So, where I've done stuff for celebrities as well. I've worked with a lot of celebrity drummers that were looking for very, very specific things. And that's something I was able to refine and get pretty good at, you know?
Okay. Wow. Yeah. That's cool. We'll circle back to celebrities and movies, because everyone, that's always cool stuff. So we got to talk about that more. This episode is brought to you by Dream Cymbals. Dream Cymbals has a masterclass with the legendary Paul Wertico coming up on Friday, April 15th at 5:30 p.m. at Steeble Drums in Cleveland, Ohio. I'm sure it's going to be awesome, so if you are in or around the great state of Ohio near Cleveland on Friday, April 15th, go check out Paul Wertico's masterclass at 5:30 p.m. at Steeble Drums. So do you have, like, in your house, like a, not a warehouse, obviously, but you keep all these parts are stocked and ready to go and categorized.
Yeah. I have the house I live in has a full basement, and downstairs I have these racks, and there's parts containers, plastic part stubs, and each one's labeled with what's in there, what brand it is, and all that kind of stuff. And I can instantly, somebody says, I need a throw off lever for a 3-point strainer on a Radio King, I know exactly where it's at. You know?
Wow.
So awesome. They need a tension rod or a rim. I have thousands of rims here, hoops of all sizes and shapes and colors, you know?
Wow.
So yeah, I'm able to put my hands on all of that.
And do you clean and process things when you find something that's all gunked up and dirty to make it nice and ready to sell?
Yeah, because my feeling, my goal is I love knowing that when somebody pulls a piece of hardware out of a box that I ship to them, like a hi-hat stand, they can actually play it.
Yeah.
And it's going to play really good, and it's going to be cleaned up. It's going to have nice rubber tips on it and the felts and all that stuff. A lot of times when you buy hardware on eBay or Facebook or Reverb, it's in pieces and it's missing parts, and some parts are stripped out. I've gone through and made sure I've retapped and dyed all the screws to make sure everything, you can actually tighten it up and the thing doesn't slip on you.
Oh, wow. So,
yeah.
Wow, that's neat. Now let's circle back a little bit, because when we're friends on Facebook, obviously, which, you know, to set this up and all this stuff, you post some really cool stuff that you like acquire that are like gold records from like the Carpenters and things like that. And I'm sure, because so you're in that specialized world beyond drums, beyond hardware. Mm-hmm. How did that happen?
Well, over the years, every once in a while, somebody would say, hey, you do eBay. I'm like, yeah. And they're like, I've got this such and such I want to sell, you know? And my attitude about it is like, well, if it's a little 25-cent trick, we ought to want to do it. But if you've got something of value that we both can make a lot of money on, I'd be more than happy to sell it. Like with Lewis Bernstein, not only did he have the drums, but he had a bunch of original Buddy Rich memorabilia, drum cases and music stands and all kinds of cool stuff. So we sold all that stuff on eBay as well. Recently, I was working for somebody. I'm still working for them. They called me up and said, I got a Ludwig drum set that was bought by this guy. He passed away recently. Can you sell it for us on a consignment? Sure, no problem. And we sold the drum set, and it all worked out. I paid them, and they were real happy with the result. And they were like, you know, we got all this memorabilia at the house. Would you be interested in selling that? I'm like, sure, why not? So I went over there, and they started pulling all this like gold records out. I was like, holy crap, this is incredible, you know. And there's more to be had. There's tons more at this place. So
wow.
Really excited to see what comes out of there.
That is neat. Have you had like an experience where you go, that was the coolest thing I've ever sold, drum related or not drum related? But like, I mean, what was in, you know, I'm putting you on the spot, but what was like the coolest thing that you've ever sold so far?
I think one of the coolest things I've ever sold, I have right now in my possession, down in the basement. I was at a drum pick yesterday, and I was picking up some drums and cymbals and stuff. And the guy had a little suitcase. And I said, what's in that suitcase? It was an Acme whistle set from the vaudeville era, and it came in a form-fitted case back then that was nice, made out of wood. It's not like some plastic case. This is probably about a 60-year-old piece of equipment. And in that case was like about 20 bird whistles. And
wow,
it's the coolest thing. It's lined in velvet and has all these beautiful whistles of every kind, man. It's freaking cool.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
But that raises the question too of like that's sort of something that might not, you might have to find the right buyer. That mm-hmm. might not be the most, to me, that's worth $1 million, but that might not be the most valuable thing to Joe Schmo on the street because it's so specialized, but the history of it, that's kind of tough where, I mean, you got to find the right buyer for this stuff, you know? I mean, that's very cool.
I've already got that sold. It's going into a museum.
Oh, there you go. That's perfect. I mean, that's it couldn't be any better than that. I mean, that is definitely a part of history. They don't make them like they used to, you know, with
all
that stuff. Okay, so you mentioned working on movies and stuff, which I'm assuming you're talking about like supplying drums that would be in a period specific movie and stuff like that. What are some of the movies you helped on?
The biggest movie we ever worked on, this is when I was still at Master Musicians in the late 1980s. There was a movie called For the Boys with Bette Midler. And they wanted 6 vintage drum sets for that. So we had to put this together quickly, you know, and they were looking for period specific 1920s, 1930s, 1940s, 1950s, and so on, you know, so we had to put a kit together for every era. And it was a big order. And they wanted to buy them. They said, well, we can either buy them or we can rent them and we'll ship them back to you. I should have gotten them back, but we sold them, you know?
Wow.
And that was back when the drums were not bringing a whole lot of money. So I think the whole order was about $6,000 or $6,500 for the whole kit.
Wow.
You know, Caboodle. And they charged the shipping to their handling company. So, but that was a really big deal. It's probably the biggest movie deal I've ever worked on. I've done some smaller things since then. I can't think of them right off the bat. I do a lot more work with celebrities is what I've really been working on.
Yeah.
Not working on, but it's not something I actively pursue. It kind of just works out that way.
Yeah. I mean, if you have the means to have someone put things together for you, like on a celebrity status, why not? Yeah. I mean, just say, hey, I want this kind of drum set. Can you name either any celebrities you've worked with and if not, maybe what, you know, celebrity X has what they typically buy?
As far as celebrity drummers go, probably the biggest celebrity I've worked for is for Charlie Watts.
Oh, great.
Yeah. That was a huge deal. And I did a lot of work for Charlie over the years. I have a whole separate episode on YouTube about that as well. Actually, 2 episodes. I don't have it. It was done with John DeChristopher. It's on his website. And he did a wonderful job of putting that together. So, yeah, we have all that.
Yeah, John has done such a cool job of keeping Charlie, not that anyone's forgetting Charlie Watts, but just keeping him in, you know, in everyone's mind and all that stuff. And I got to meet him at a Stone show in New Orleans. And just what a there are very few drummers who have the means to buy those drums and also be so passionate about it. It's just unbelievable. I remember him talking about, he told me that he had, I believe it was like Sonny Greer's drum set.
Yes.
Was that you?
No, that's Steve Maxwell.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. Well, I'm sure. I mean, you guys are, there's a couple, you know, I'm sure you guys are, you're obviously in the same business doing some of that stuff, but, it doesn't get much cooler than providing drums for one of the biggest rock stars in the world.
Yeah. You know, what's interesting about that also is for many years that I worked for Charlie, he was just not interested in buying vintage drums just to buy vintage drums for collecting purposes. Any drum that he bought from me for a long time was specifically for a particular application. He bought a drum set for me for the Rolling Stones, the big stage. And then he bought a drum set for me for the jazz band that he played in, you know, so that was, they were very specific. And again, they were never bought at that time to collect. It was all to actually use them.
Wow.
Yeah. Wow. It wasn't until much later, like in the later 90s, maybe even the early 2000s, that he actually started collecting and putting the word out there, you know?
Yeah.
So that changed.
I mean, people have their specific, you know, from the beginner collector up to Charlie Watts, they have their specific, I'm not going to be collecting, I'm going to actually use this versus I'm going to have a warehouse full of artifacts and and very, very collectible items, which, man, I hope Don McCauley can get that a museum put together with Charlie's or whoever can get it put together with Charlie's amazing collection someday. That would be cool. So going back to the movie thing real quick, it's so neat that the attention to detail on that movie to have these period correct drums, because really, I mean, then you got to think there's probably period correct, pianos and everything in the music sequences. Six different drum sets. That's amazing that they had that level of detail.
Yeah, the property master was the guy that was setting this all up, and their attention to detail is very important and relevant to the movie that they're making, and they're paid a lot of money to be exacting in their detail.
Yeah.
And the gentleman that was doing that was a gentleman, I believe his name was Lewis Fleming, was the name of the property master for that show. And he'd been around forever. He was a old time Hollywood, prop master.
Yeah.
You know, and he had a lot of experience in doing that. So, cause I looked him up on Wikipedia or something like that. And there he was. He'd done all kinds of movies, quite a list. I don't know if he's still with us anymore.
Interesting. That's a neat job. I the studio I work at, there was a movie that got filmed there that was called Girl from Compton. It was when the Straight Outta Compton, movie was coming out, and it was about Dr. Dre's ex-wife or girlfriend, Michelle A. And they would come in and convert things and have period correct TVs and stuff. But I mean, they didn't really. Like we have a giant MCI board that's kind of been the middle parts taken out, and an Avid, like a Pro Tools kind of rig, is put in a C24 for people audio nerds listening. But that didn't go that much farther than that, because it was like a Lifetime or a Hallmark movie. Because it's time and attention and it really adds up. So for the level of production for like a big Bette Midler movie in that era wouldn't make sense. But gosh, you wonder what happened to those drums after they bought it. Maybe it went to his warehouse and they used it in later movies, you know?
Yeah, I'm a big movie buff. So every time I go to California, I go to all the different, Universal lot, the Warner Brothers lot. And I've been through their property storage areas, which are massive. If you ever saw the end of the Raiders of the Lost Ark, there's a scene where they're going through this massive warehouse. It's like that. It's huge, man.
Wow.
They got everything.
You know, after all that work, though, I was just watching a movie. I'd never seen Arthur, and I just watched Arthur the other night, which classic movie. But there was a scene where he's walking into a, or stumbling, I should say, into a restaurant, and the drummer was like playing, but it was the most ridiculous. Like he was like keeping time, like riding on his tom, and then just like not synced up at all. So after all this hard work of like matching stuff up, it kind of comes down to the background actor drummer, which sometimes you look and you go, you're not even halfway resembling something real. Did you, when you watched the movie, were you like, were you happy with the performance of the drummer?
Yeah, I was really happy because I right around the same time, maybe a few years earlier, Gary Busey had done a movie called The Buddy Holly Story. And it'll drive you crazy as a drummer, because the Buddy Holly takes place in the late 50s, early 60s. And here's a drummer playing a kit that's flagrantly from the 70s with the 70s Ludwig logo on it and all the hardware. I'm like, no, but only us drummers would know that. The regular person on the street would be, oh, it's a drummer playing a drum set, whatever.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure there are websites devoted to these, mistakes in movies where you're watching a 1950s movie and there's like a Honda Accord in the back or something like that,
or a microphone hanging down,
Well, microphones are interesting. I always heard that the Howard Stern movie Private Parts was extremely detailed with the microphone choices of each microphone through the period of his dad working at the radio station, which that's a great movie. But now, all right, so let's talk a little bit about how things have changed with collecting as far as then to now with the prices. I mean, things have really, really gotten a lot more expensive. You're in the hardware business specifically, but obviously I'm sure you still do the drums and stuff.
Yeah.
Has it slowed things down where people are buying less because the prices have gotten higher, you think?
If you have a good quality kit that hasn't been mucked around with and it's nice and original, you'll always be able to sell it. There's a lot of kits out there that over the years that people have drilled extra holes and modified, But the rare pieces seem to command more and more money nowadays. You know, the really rare stuff like the Gretsch Gladstones, the Black Beauties have always remained consistent. We used to think Black Beauties were like maybe only 10 ever made. Now we've come to find out that they made hundreds of them. Mm-hmm. And we used to think that Radio Kings were exquisitely rare. And now we've seen that they, you know, because of Gene Krupa, they made hundreds of those too. I run into them all the time. But it's the really rare pieces, you know, like the little Gretsch 4x14 bebop snare drums, the Cadillac Green kits, the Camco kits have really gone up in value.
Yeah.
I mean, Camco kits really command thousands of dollars. You know, so
yeah,
it's interesting to see that.
Yeah, things go up and down. But Camco, I mean, I guess it's really a matter of supply and demand. And if there's less supply, then demand goes through the roof.
Yeah.
Do you have a drum set where, like, it could be Camco or like a, you know, the Gretsch Gladstones or a Gladstone where it's really kind of, again, holy grail moments? What would be some one that comes to mind that's just like, like drum set wise that was an absolute mega, you know, find and or consignment deal?
Mm-hmm. I think the Ludwig Citrus Mod is probably one of the rarest things I've come across. A guy here in Maryland a number of years ago had a Citrus Mod kit and he called me up and he says, I need this. Sell my kit. I've got some financial trouble. I'm like, what is it? He says, oh, it's a Ludwig Citrus Mod. You know, I'm like, oh boy. So I didn't even have it yet. I had a photograph of it that he sent to me on the, I guess on the text or something. And I sent that to Bunny Carlos and Bunny was like, I'll take it. So like a month later, I was going to the Chicago Drum Show. I brought it with me. That way he didn't have to pay for shipping.
That's smart. Which
very cool.
Man, shipping is a whole thing. I mean, In your world, especially, I mean, well, I guess parts are smart. You're smart on many levels with the parts thing because that's a little easier to ship. But
yep.
I mean, you gotta. I think everyone's had that where drums or not drums or whatever, anything that you ship, where you it's kind of hard to calculate shipping. I'm sure you figure it out how to really do it. But what are some tips you have for people on how to ship correctly and not get burned with prices?
I try to use post office whenever I can, because post office can be really competitive when it comes to small parts or a small drum that's very light, you know. Yeah. I generally otherwise use FedEx Ground otherwise for everything. Unless I'm shipping internationally, then I got to go through the post office. I've had a lot of experience shipping internationally over the years, and I've done pretty well with shipping. I haven't damaged or had anything broken as a result of my shipping progress or prowess in probably 30 years.
Wow.
You know, I'm talking Bistolite drum sets and stuff like that. And so the first thing I try to always tell people is you got to take on the bass drums is you got to take all the T-rods and claws off and take the drum head off. And you also got to take off all of what I call the bullet points, like the spurs and the brackets, any tom holders and any cymbal brackets, take them off. So the bass drum just has the lugs on it. And then I wrap that with two layers of bubble pack. And then I wrap a cardboard cylinder around the bass drum. So the bass drum like in its own cylinder. And then I put that into a larger box, you know. And then and if I have a floor tom or a rack tom to put inside of that, I make sure that there's no way that any of the metal parts on the floor tom can rub up it on the inside of the bass drum and scratch up either the parts or the inside of the bass drum. So, yeah.
Yeah. So when people then get that drum set, they have to then assemble for safety. That's obviously the best thing, but they're putting the spurs back on. They're putting the stuff. And I mean, really, the drum sets you're selling, it's not going to little Billy for Christmas, who's got his first drum set. I mean, these are collectors who know how to do all that and put it back together correctly.
Yeah. Most people are okay with that. I mean, they respect the fact that they're getting a drum set that's been properly packed and they're willing to accept the fact that they're going to have to put a little bit of work into putting it back together. But also it gives them an opportunity to examine the drums more closely and also to maybe do some cleaning that they might not otherwise do. But generally, I like to send the drums all ready to go, cleaned up, polished.
Yeah.
From every lug, every rim, you know, everything's cleaned up, you know. So,
yeah,
I think it's worth it.
I was selling for Gwyn Sound, the studio I work for, when we got a new owner and it was kind of like, let's clear out a bunch of the old, you know, how studios sometimes have like a room full of just old outboard gear and like stuff like I believe it was like one of those, it was like a MIDI control, like a box where your sounds would be in this outboard gear or whatever, something like that. Yeah. I was selling a bunch of stuff on Reverb and it was all going great. There was one item though, and I can't remember exactly what it was. I think it was, like I said, like a brain for a, you know, keyboard or something. But I packed it all up really, really nicely. I put a lot of, you know, I wrapped the, just the bejesus out of everything. But I got a note from the buyer sending me a picture. This thing looks like it had fallen off the plane. Mm-hmm. They had like the ears, you know, the rack mount, you know, on the sides were completely bent. The metal, the thick metal was completely twisted. And I'm thinking, how does that even happen? So of course I gave a refund. I don't think it was a super expensive piece of equipment, but, you got to plan for the worst. So you're smart to take things apart and cause drums are wood and things break.
I did have an interesting situation. I had to ship a Simmons SDS-7 Brain to France. Hmm. And I, like you said, I packed it carefully, bubble packed everything. And they must have run over it with a brick, with a bulldozer or something. Guy sent me a picture from France and I was like, oh my God, it was all twisted and smashed in. And they, of course, they wouldn't honor, you know, the insurance. They were like, no, we won't cover it. You know, so I had to fully refund him. I lost the money shipping there and the shipping back. It says, I want it back. So I ended up selling it for parts because the parts for those things are just as valuable as the thing itself. So I was able to get a little bit of money back, but it was a huge loss. It's just every once in a while, something will get a catastrophic, you know, damage done to it by, and a lot of times they're not always very good about covering it, especially if you're shipping to a country.
Yeah.
But a lot of times they're going to be like, eh, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's so much going on that, and, but actually that's really smart. And I think that's something to touch on is the, sometimes having a drum set and all the parts seems like from time to time you can make more money parting things out.
Yeah.
But then you're kind of, you don't want to break up a nice drum set. But like if you have a tom and like a floor tom, like orphan stuff, that it is possible to, or taking off, like you said, certain elements of the hardware that you can make more parting things out.
Yeah, there are people that do that, you know, and I don't begrudge them because, I mean, they're trying to make a living, but they'll take basically a whole drum set and part every screw out. And that's something I've never adhered to. I've always sold whole drums or whole drum sets or snare drums. I've never parted them out because I just feel something, there's something wrong with that. But that's just me. I don't criticize anybody else for doing that. You know?
Yeah.
I understand that everybody's out to make a buck, but what really gets me is that on eBay, you'll see, and on Reverb too, where people will put up like a screw, and it's not even a Slingland screw. It's like a Japanese screw, and they're like $20 for this screw. I'm like, what the heck? I don't get it.
No, because I guess sometimes there's like, you know, you can find the keyword of like, this is the right size for that drum, but it might not be correct and all that stuff. Have you ever come across, I imagine for everyone, it's like, you know, the ultimate, but like new old stock stuff. What's your experience with that?
I've had a lot of experience finding new old stock drums, hardware, and electronic drum equipment, you know, because I'm really big into the vintage drum, you know, the Simmons, the Tama, all that stuff, and Roland and Sinair and Synect, Syndrum. So whenever I find it, I get just as excited over that because I love that stuff, you know.
Yeah.
And it's wonderful when you can find stuff like that. It doesn't, just because it's new old stock in the box, though, doesn't mean it's going to be mint. A lot of times things can oxidize inside of a box. You can pull a stand out and it won't be rusted, but it'll be completely oxidized. All the chrome will be dull because it's oxidized and all the alloy pieces will be oxidized because it's just old. They've just been sitting there for a million years. And a lot of times they didn't wrap them with a whole lot of protective, like clear plastic. They wrapped them in paper and the paper doesn't do a really good job of always keeping the moisture out. You know?
So
it's still fun though. I love finding, you know, new boxes. It's like, just the boxes I get excited over.
Yeah. I mean, I think everyone listening would know this, but new old stock obviously refers to like, you know, maybe a, I don't know, like a drum store closed and then the building, no one went into the building and the back room is just full of all these parts and stuff. So that's what that, and that's every industry. You see like motorcycle stuff and all this, like the back room is just like, but, and then it's just neat to see, like you said, the old packaging and all this, that cool stuff. Does that raise the value? It has to be a little bit more valuable because it's original.
Yeah, it can raise the value, especially if you have something exquisitely rare, like a snare drum, like an old Gretsch or Roger snare drum, is still in its original box. That could really raise the value, you know, especially if it's got the part number on the side that's coherent to the part, to the drum itself, you know?
Yeah.
So that's cool. That happens every once in a while.
Very cool. All right. So what, going back a little bit to like, you know, talking about drum shows and stuff like that. how do you think everything, I mean, there's a lot of drum shows now, and I mean, it's such a cool community, as we all know, there's a drum show and the drummer community is just great. Do you make it out to a lot of the drum shows still? And what do you think is going on? How do you see things now versus in, you know, let's say 90 when things, 32 years ago when things were just starting out?
I try to go to every drum show I can possibly get my hands on. I mean, I've even been to the West Coast for the Hollywood drum show. I try to go to anyone I can go to because I think they're all relevant. And I always try to encourage anybody who plays drums to check out a drum show, because I always tell them, you're going to love it. You're going to have such a great time looking at all this stuff, hearing new products, because the drum shows also have new products as well as vintage products. And so it's a great opportunity to really test out new merchandise, you know. Yeah. And it's just a great hang, you know, because there's so many great people, you know, even with some of the younger guys that are coming into the business now, us old folks, we like to bring them on, and we all go out to dinner and shoot the crap. And it's great. It's a great community. It's one of the nicest communities I can imagine. You know, everybody is just really gets along great. And even though we're somewhat competitive, we're not, you know, stomping on each other's, stepping over each other to steal something or buy something out from underneath. So yeah. If I hear somebody's buying or interested in something, I back off.
Yeah.
So yeah. We have a great relationship.
Yeah. You don't hear many bad things. And I think it's true that if someone is being dishonest or a little shifty, people hear about it. I mean, yeah. There's times where I hear about things where, you know, I'm on the podcast, more the interview side of things here in Cincinnati. And it's like, I'm hearing about a guy who's doing some shifty stuff like in England on eBay. And I'm like, how's this getting to me? So word travels.
It does.
Your reputation is important. And seems like the only way to really grow your reputation is to just be there and do it and be honest. Yeah. It's like each sale sort of builds up your reputation one stone at a time. And I'm sure there is got to be some competition, like you and like Steve Maxwell and these guys and Don Bennett, these guys who were like dealing with high level drum sets.
Yeah.
Are sort of going after the same people, but I'm sure you guys are all very respectful and there's enough meat on the bone for everyone.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm very fortunate because I have a clientele that I deal with that they're pretty reliable and I still do a lot of business with them on a regular basis. And I don't really have to go looking for it. I don't have to call them up and say, hey, I'm looking for this, or are you looking to buy this drum? Or
yeah,
it's very laid back. There's not a whole lot of push or competition because of that.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. It's such a cool thing though. And there's a lot of, collectors. It seems like there's a lot of, people who have the means to buy these drum sets and keep them safe, which that's the best thing too, is these drums aren't going to, you know, the dump or anything like that. Cause I'm sure that historically there's been times where some guy is just like clearing out an attic and has thrown away like, you know, a Black Beauty or something like that.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah, we've all heard stories about how we just missed out where you go to a house or see somebody and they, oh, yeah, my neighbor just threw out this funky old drum set. I'm like, no. You hear about that all the time. The most biggest one I've ever heard of is when Ludwig was closing down their plant in Chicago. And rather than move all this inventory down to South Carolina where they're based now, they just threw it all away. And there were literally dumpsters full of new old stock Ludwig parts that I would have bought every bit of it, but they just took all that stuff and threw it all away. Drums, parts, drum heads. Oh, it just breaks your heart.
Yeah. Wow. Mm-hmm. I mean, I guess it's because of the logistical nightmare of like parting it out and selling it and taking the pictures. And well, then I guess there wouldn't be an eBay. You know, there's no internet then, but I guess it's just easier to just destroy it.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's very different because like when Rogers was in the process of dismantling the business, who CBS Instruments owned Rogers, they basically put it out there and they sold a lot of that stuff to different dealers around the country. My good friend Dave Drew over at Al Drew's Music bought a huge amount of inventory from Rogers and had it shipped over to his warehouse in Woonsocket, Rhode Island. And so Rogers was really cool about that. Slingland, when they got bought out, Gretsch bought them out, so a lot of Slingland inventory went down to the Gretsch factory, and I guess they're in South Carolina also. So we're very fortunate they did that, because Ludwig, like I said, they just tossed all that stuff out.
Yeah, and guys like Bernie Stone, who has he was on the show, and he bought the old radio frequency stuff, which that was a cool one. I get a lot of comments on Bernie's episode. People liked how he figured out the mathematical equations to make this equipment work. But
I've been there. Yeah, he went through a lot of trouble to get that stuff back up and running. You know.
Yeah.
You know, an interesting story about the Slingland factory is that Buddy Carlos, who's probably one of the bigger collectors out there for many years. He was, for a very short time, he was endorsing Slingland drums for like a year, and he was playing a black drum set with copper hardware. Well, they called him up and said, hey, we're closing down the factory. If you want to come by and help yourself to anything you want. So he went down there and just kind of scooped up a bunch of bits and pieces. And a lot of it was his copper plated parts, you know. And it's funny how they did, different companies handle things differently. You know, they were willing to let people come in. Slingland was willing to let people come into their... They had a Chicago plant in, just outside of Chicago in Niles, Illinois. And they let people come in there and just grab stuff. Whereas Ludwig, they just threw it all away.
Jeez. Man, if, you know, it is what it is. You can't change it. But, well, Richard, this has just been awesome. So I am going to be at the Covington Rogers drum show that Po Shai puts on. I think I'm going to have a booth with Vincent Ward, who's at Junk Rock Drums and Vitalizer Drums. And basically, I don't really have anything to like put on. I have a little sign and some business cards. But so I'll be there with Vincent because he's got things to actually sell. But then I'll be at, I think I'm going to have to miss Chicago this year because my wife is having a baby 2 weeks before. And I'd like to not get my head ripped off by asking to even by bringing that up to go to a drum show 2 weeks later. But I plan on being at the Music City drum show in Nashville in July.
Okay.
For everyone listening. And then I will probably be at PASIC in November. And I've never been to NAMM. I'd like to go to NAMM in January.
That's a blast.
So are you, which shows are you going to be at this year? And so maybe people can come up and say hi to you. And
I'll definitely be in Chicago. I don't usually get a booth. I just kind of wander around aimlessly, but I'll be in Chicago all 3 days, the dealer load in day and then the two actual show days. I'm hoping to go to the Music Expo down in Nashville as well. I am not going to go to the Rogers thing because I have a gig that weekend. Otherwise I'd love to come down there because I'm good friends with Jeff Burke and Po Shai. They're really, really nice people.
Yep.
And they always put on a great show. I'd love to go to that. And Vincent's a good friend of mine also. He lives right here in
Maryland that's right.
as well.
Yeah.
He's been over here. He can tell you stories.
Yep. Yep. Vincent's awesome. We've kind of become, I mean, we're like we're kind of around the same age, and he's really helped me out a lot with, I kind of bounce ideas off of him and doing the whole Patreon bonus thing, which we'll do in a little bit and talk about. That was Vincent's idea. And it's worked out great. But, Richard, as we wrap up here, I think we're going to do a Patreon bonus episode here for a couple minutes. And what I'd like to maybe talk about is, I don't know. I think a lot of folks who listen to the show they either work at drum stores, they buy and sell drums. So maybe we could pick your brain, when we do it and get like tips that you found on eBay for some keywords that you like to use or things like, you know, photography and things that you've learned over it to get some tips on how to sell drums. You don't have to give away your industry, your secrets, but maybe we do a start to finish, like you acquire it, you shoot it, you itemize it, all that stuff. Does that sound good?
Sure.
Cool. Well, if people want to hear that, they can go to drumhistorypodcast.com and click the Patreon link and follow and join up and get cool perks like that. Richard, why don't you take this time now here to kind of tell people where they can find you if they want to reach out and maybe get some hardware or deal with you with buying and selling drums or anything like that.
Yeah, well, my name is King's Music on eBay. I've been there for, since 2002, I'm sorry. On Facebook, you can just find me as Richard King. I think that's about it. I don't really have a website anymore. I got rid of all that stuff. But you can always contact me. Facebook's the best way to do that.
Sure.
Because people seem to find that much easier.
Yeah. That's the way it's worked, I think, because that's how I connected with you is, I don't know, websites are a lot. I have one for the podcast, obviously, but websites are a lot to handle, especially if you're on eBay and all that stuff. Yeah. So, Richard, this has been awesome. So I do want to, before we wrap up, I want to thank Anthony Amadeo for suggesting you for this.
Thank you, Anthony. He's a great guy. I love Anthony.
Yep. And obviously Lewis Bernstein, who kind of put your name in my ear to begin with his episode, which was a really fun one. So this is awesome. Richard, thank you for being on the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you, Bart. It's a pleasure to be here.
If you like this podcast, find me on social media at Drum History and please share, rate, and leave a review. And let me know topics that you would like to learn about in the future. Until next time, keep on learning.